You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 4th of September 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, a scathing editorial in the New York Times has not dissuaded the Australian Prime Minister from offering advice on solving Europe's migrant and refugee crisis. It is, says Tony Abbott, all about stopping the boats. I'll ask my studio guests Isabel Hilton and Tim Marshall what they think. We'll also be looking at the day's other big stories, including China, where a parade commemorating victory over Japan 70 years ago has taken a noticeable uniformed approach. We'll ask what the People's Republic might be trying to tell us. We'll also discuss the first ever gay love story to hit Chinese cinema screens. Plus, is declaring personal wealth a good idea for political leaders? Believe it or not, Nigeria's president says yes. That's all coming up on Midori House, live from Studio One on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Isabel Hilton, CEO of ChinaDialogue.net, and Tim Marshall, former diplomatic editor of Sky News, now editor of thewhatandthewhy.com. Welcome both. As we speak, a column of several hundred migrants is on the march from Budapest, where they've been prevented from boarding trains west, heading in the direction of the Austrian border. Across Europe, politicians are dizzying themselves in an attempt to keep in front of a widespread reversal of public sentiment prompted by one dreadful photograph. And a world away, however, Australia's Prime Minister Tony Abbott is sticking to his belief that the way to stop people drowning is to stop the boats they are sailing on. Tim, first of all, even if, and it's a debatable proposition right here, Australia's policy has been successful on its own merits, the example is completely irrelevant to European geography, isn't it?
No.
No?
You're still talking about getting across water. And it's also the principle of the matter. I'm not saying I agree with Mr. Abbott at all, but the principle that if everybody that wants to come in direction A realizes that they cannot do that, they will cease to come in direction A. And that is exactly what has happened in Australia. They have been utterly ruthless, and there used to be hundreds of people drowning, and now there aren't. So that is a success in those terms. And consequently, if you take that template and you say to the people, you know what's going to happen when you wash up in Turkey or you wash up in Greece or wherever? What's going to happen is that before you even get there, someone's going to attach a rope to your boat and tow it back to Libya. That would actually stop people making that journey. They'll make other journeys, which are incredibly dangerous. But you know, you asked me about whether it's germane to that argument, and it is.
Isn't the difference, though, just to follow that up, that in Europe, you're quite right. If you close off Route A, people will stop coming along Route A. Yeah. But where Australia's concerned, because of where it is, there really is only Route A. Whereas if you're trying to travel from North Africa or the Middle East to Europe, there's routes B, C, D, and D.
Which will and are already being taken. I'm actually slightly more concerned about the policy in Australia people are taken to Papua New Guinea, but they're also taken to the island of Nauru. And the stuff that's going on there in the camps that they're putting people
just the stuff
are
we know
absolutely
about.
Disgusting and disgraceful. And the Australian media are trying to get there. And I've only read today that the Nauru, if you want to get a journalist visa, it used to be $200. Since the accusations have come up about the treatment of people, asylum seekers, in those camps, it is now $8,000 for a journalist visa. And you don't get a refund if you get turned down. There's something very dark going on there. But sorry, to bring it back, you asked me about, is it germane? It is. It has been a successful policy. It is reasonably popular in Australia. And also, I'm not sure it breaks the legal duty you have towards refugees. The moral duty? That's another question.
Isabel, is there something in that, the basic principle of just removing any possible incentive to travel, what's being called the pull factor, or is the case where the Europe migration crisis is concerned, we are far beyond that being even a consideration at this point?
I honestly think we're far beyond that. I mean, certainly the Syrian, in the Syrian case, people have very little choice but to flee a war which is destroying their homes and killing them. And you and I would do the same thing. I think where the Australian case is interesting, and exactly because of the difficulties that are being created to get to Nauru and see what's going on, that so much of public response is about visibility. And I think that the impact of that photograph that you talked about on the way the story was reported was that people went and talked to the father, the sort of the grief-stricken surviving father. They discovered that he was a human being too, that he had a perfectly valid claim to go to Canada where his sister was trying to support him, would have supported him. That all of those routes for this very reasonable and attractive family had been closed off. That transforms the way people see them. You know, we have leaders who talk about swarms. We have this tendency to talk about migrants instead of refugees, and to see people.
You've just made them human. Yeah, you've just made them human in that paragraph, and that is what the media. And briefly, also, I think another change that has happened is the footage of seeing people walking across Europe. I think that's had a huge effect, and it's also made them a bit more human.
And you know what? It says 1945. That's what that footage says.
I've been thinking to myself, if we do not sort this and do the right thing, and I don't have the answer, history will look back at us the way that we look back at people in the late 30s that abandoned the Jews of Europe. However, it's so easy to say all that. The hard stuff, the really hard stuff is, hang on, legally, you are a you have a moral and legal obligation to a refugee once they have refugee status, which is when they are outside of their own country. The moment they are in a place of safety where they are no longer in fear of death, they do not have the legal right to go any further. They may have the moral right. And as soon as you get into this legality, then you get into politics.
That's where the buck passing starts.
Which is what's going on at the moment.
Well, absolutely. But, you know, we made those rules in Dublin. We can, in as far as the European Union goes, we can change them. Yeah. And there have been efforts to do so. So, I all of those obstacles that, you know, are presented by politicians were made by politicians and can be changed. And I think it's interesting the degree to which we've seen politicians scrambling, you know, to assert leadership from behind, certainly in Britain's case, in the most, you know, embarrassing way.
But driven by headlines.
Driven by headlines. But the headlines then generated, you know, a rather, in my view, shaming public response for the Prime Minister, in that ordinary people were saying, I'll take one, you know, football fans waving banners, all that kind of thing. Mm. Tory politicians saying, you know, we have to take people. Of course we do.
I just want to ask you both about that shift in mood in the last 48 hours in particular before we move on, and whether how solid you think it is. Because, I mean, from a sort of a long-term reader of British newspapers, it is always an impressive spectacle watching the tabloid press turn their guns around with the absolute shamelessness that they do. We are at war with East Asia. We've always been at war with East Asia, etc. Tim, how solid and how long-lasting do you think the shift in opinion that appears to have been, you know, prompted by that one photograph is?
I dislike always having to be the realist, but that is the, you know, it's my hinterland. Let's take an example from a year ago when those poor girls in Nigeria were kidnapped. And before you knew it, you had Mrs. Obama, Michelle Obama, with a sign and a selfie saying, bring back our girls.
If only she had some sort of access to people in positions of power.
And this was a thing for several weeks, and it was the most important story in the world. Nobody even thinks about those girls, and most of them have not been rescued. So this is the point you're making about the media and also the public's attention span. And I regret to say that I think when that harrowing image of that child, which has been a temporary game changer, starts to fade, the hard politics of Hungary and the fact that the population does not want to take people, the hard politics of this country, David Cameron, having to renegotiate Britain's position within the EU, if he now takes 100,000 refugees, and you can make the moral argument that we absolutely should, but if he does, what about that massive section of the electorate that says, right, I'm going to vote no, and we're going to get out of Europe in the British referendum. So what I'm saying is that the hard politics will survive the temporary emotion.
Getting out of Europe doesn't change the moral obligation to refugees.
No, but it doesn't. But it also doesn't. But the point is that when we talk about morality, they're talking about politics. And once the tension has moved on, there will still be those people in this country that do not want refugees here and who do not want to be in Europe. And if Mr. Cameron, and this is the politics of it, if Mr. Cameron gives in, to use the language that would be used, then he will lose the referendum and Britain will get out of the EU. So all that stuff flows into these arguments when the politicians behind closed doors are trying to make their decisions and all politics is local.
I come back to visibility. Those girls disappeared.
Yeah.
Actually, how do you find them? How do you rescue them? These people are not going to disappear. These people are currently, as you say, walking in a long, distressing column across Europe. It's not going to go away. And I think that, you know, something rather, I don't think you can, that tomorrow or next week it will be dismissible.
I hope you're right.
Well, let's look now at China, which has just staged a spectacle sure to have stirred something in those of Cold War vintage who, despite themselves, always furtively enjoyed those parades of tanks, intercontinental missiles and goose-stepping legions being glowered over by hatchet-faced communists perched upon reviewing stands. Beneath suspiciously clear Beijing skies, China celebrated the 70th anniversary of the end of the War of Chinese People's Resistance against Japanese aggression with an old-school display of martial potence. Isabel, who was the intended audience for this?
Oh, good question. Well, there were two, I think. There was the television audience in China, and then there was the American Navy. And I think the American Navy was paying extremely close attention.
Tim, what did you make of it? Because the thing is, obviously there's going to be a martial element to a parade commemorating the end of a war. Perfectly fair enough. Everybody does that, if not necessarily in such grandiose style. But the Chinese People's Republic of China, whatever else you may think of it, has made extraordinary strides in other areas over the last 70 years. Why exclude all of that, do you think?
Because it was the 70th anniversary. Look, if we had the 70th anniversary of VE Day, we wouldn't go banging on, well, we might go banging on about the health service in the UK, but we'd actually, you know, the majority of it would be the military side of it. I agree completely with Isabella. The Dongfeng 21D missile, this is the one that was aimed at the Navy and literally will be aimed at the Navy. It's called a carrier killer. The Americans have, I think, 12 aircraft carrier groups. China doesn't have any. It's got one old carrier. It's trying
secondhand.
To, yeah, secondhand, bought from Ukraine. Sorry, the point being that they drove these massive missiles, these carrier killers, through the streets of Beijing in front of the television cameras for the whole world and the US Navy to see, because they know they're 20 to 30 years behind on the carrier technology. So they're putting a lot of money into shore-to-ship missiles that can kill the American Navy to say, back off. And that's what the parade, that was the message for me.
Isabel, are they even bothering trying to impress the Japanese as well at this point? Or was it an entirely a message to Washington?
Oh, well, I think the Japanese are included as, you know, as Washington's best friend in the region. I mean, they're really saying to all of Washington's friends in the region, don't imagine that Washington is going to come to your aid because we will sink Washington's, you know, star battle groups. And as well as the 21D, they also revealed that another missile with a far longer range, the Guam killer, also had an anti-ship
potential. That's the one that can allegedly reach all the way to the island of Guam.
Absolutely.
Halfway across the Pacific.
Absolutely. Now, if that also has anti-ship potential, that excludes the American Navy from a whole other, you know, tract of sea in the Chinese calculation. So this is all about denial of access to the US Navy. And that, you know, the theory is that it changes the balance of power without having to have your own battle group.
Yeah,
because you can deny the operations of the other battle group. The US doesn't have these missiles because in 1987, they signed a deal with Russia not to develop them, the Soviet Union not to develop them. So it is a very interesting strategic challenge. The Americans have known about this for, you know, two or three years. They don't sit around not paying attention. But this was very in your face from the Chinese. And I'm sure that the Americans will be scratching around trying to figure out. We haven't seen them tested, so we don't know whether they can really hit a ship. And there are a lot of complications about hitting a ship at that range. But certainly the assumption will be, the working assumption will be that they have a fair go at it, and there needs to be some defence against it.
And just picking up on what you said about the message to the Japanese is, don't think your big brother's going to stand by you. I think this is absolutely crucial. It's in the, you know, I've got this new book out, Prisoners of Geography.
You're allowed to mention it.
Thank you.
Perfectly okay.
How many times? Prisoners of Geography. The chapter on China makes the point that every single time they bump up against each other, you cannot lose face. Because if the Americans lose face one, two, three, four times, the Japanese start thinking, oh, maybe I can't count on them. oh, the Vietnamese thing, oh, I'm not sure what's going on. And so every single time it's going to be dangerous when they bump, because the Chinese will try to make sure that everybody gets into their sphere of influence. The Americans are trying to keep everyone in their sphere of influence, and you cannot lose face. And so every time they bump, and they will bump, let's hope they deal with it in a very grown-up manner.
Just finally on this one, before we take a break, Isabel, I did want to ask you about, there was a couple of other, I guess, subplots to this, which I just wondered what you might think about what they say about where China generally is, which I realise is a big question. On the one hand, there was the very old-school totalitarian micromanagement, you know, closing the factories to guarantee blue skies, using monkeys to dismantle birds' nests, taking entertainment shows off the air so there's nothing else for people to watch. But that, coupled with the fact that on Weibo, on social media, there are an awful lot of people making fun of it very, very quickly before their posts got taken down by, China's internet vigilantes. But nonetheless, how is it possible to say how many Chinese, especially young modern Chinese, are watching this very old school display and just thinking, come on?
It's almost impossible to say with any accuracy because, you know, you're just looking at, you know, samples on Weibo and Weixin. But there is a parallel with the other big, rather bombastic event on television, which is the annual New Year show. And that regularly produces satirical versions and people kind of yawn and groan because it is also very old-fashioned, mass choirs singing patriotic songs and all that kind of stuff. So you know, there are certainly a generation, there is a young generation of nationalistic Chinese who have been, you know, fed the Kool-Aid of the communist version of history and probably, you know, have very little to play it off against. But there's also a more sophisticated audience which just, you know, has travelled and just recognises this for what it is.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, along with Isabel Hilton and Tim Marshall. Coming up next, we will be looking at an extraordinary display, or an unlikely display, perhaps, of transparency by a West African president and an innovation in Chinese cinema.
At Monocle, we love a well-run city, and one capital that deserves that epitaph is Tokyo. But its charms run so much deeper. Monocle's new travel guide to Tokyo shows a balance of old and new, and we highlight the city's best fashion retailers, bars, and welcoming restaurants that the usual guides might overlook.
Nowhere else on the planet can match Tokyo for shopping. When it comes to customer service, choice, and sheer quality, the city is without parallel. Japanese shoppers expect the best, and retailers don't like to disappoint. You might not plan to, but a visit to Tokyo will always involve some serious shopping. Resistance is futile.
Check out our new film celebrating the Monocle Travel Guide to Tokyo in the film section of monocle.com.
Join Monocle 24's international editors and correspondents as they touch down in a different city each week for our brilliant new travel programme. Come on board for a one-stop audio guide to the most dynamic emerging cities around the world. This week, we're in Istanbul. As well as hospitality highlights and key cultural hotspots, we'll also visit new retail spaces, sample the local food scene, and meet the design denizens that a potentially time-poor traveller can ill afford to miss. The Voyager, in association with Turkish Airlines, is now boarding.
And welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me are Isabel Hilton and Tim Marshall. Now, it's long been the case that high on the list of Africa's biggest problems are the people who are supposed to spend their working hours solving them, the generations of larcenous leaders who have looted billions from their national treasuries. In a move intended to either or both reassure his own people and embarrass his peers, Nigeria's newish president, Muhammadu Buhari, has publicly declared his assets. It turns out that President Buhari is by no means poor. He has 100 grand in the bank, plus property and business interests. But the message is clear. Bokassa or Mubarak or Mugabe or Amin or Mobutu, he is not, or so he would have us believe. Tim, how significant a gesture is this?
Well, it is a gesture, and it does send a message to the Nigerian business elite that I might have a look at you. I do take it with a pinch of salt, though, I'm afraid. I'm not calling the man corrupt, certainly not in the league of people that you just mentioned.
That's pretty much the elite, in fairness.
Yeah. But, you know, okay, he's got £100,000 in his current account. He's got shares in three firms. He's got land, property, farm. You know, but it's good that he is saying we need to go down this route, because everybody knows that Nigeria is one of the most corrupt countries in the world. So good. Make a gesture. Say that this is the route that we're now going to try to go down. And let's see if there's any independent journalists in the country who have a look, a very, very close look, to see if there are any other current accounts. And let's hope they're not. And let's hope that he means what he says.
Isabel, as Tim points out, Nigeria is it's legendarily crooked at absolutely every level. On Transparency International's index, it ranks 136th out of 175 countries. Which, it's up there with the big ones on this front. How important an example does this set? Are other Nigerian politicians inspired by this relative honesty, or are the moneyed elites likely to be just thinking, God, what an idiot?
Well, I think it's pretty important. I mean, as he points out, there is $150 billion are missing from Nigeria's public accounts. That's quite a lot of money. I like his list, actually. 25 sheep, 5 horses, a variety of birds. He seems to have gone into a certain amount of detail.
There's
there.
A mortgage on a flat in Bedford as well,
that
I think,
very
I remember
curious.
Reading somewhere.
Yes, it is odd. But bought 2 cars from his savings. If this is really the total, and presumably, if there is more, he's hidden it rather well, because he's rather exposed himself to scrutiny here. I think it's a very good gesture. Xi Jinping, just to dip back into China, is running a great anti-corruption campaign right now. But when citizens suggested that officials should be invited to disclose their assets, maybe they'll get out of jail soon, but they're certainly in jail now. So it was definitely, we will investigate who we want to investigate, and we will discover what we want to discover. Whereas this is, this is what I've got, and I challenge. It puts a moral challenge out there to other politicians to do the same. If not, why not? I would love to see Tony Blair do it. I'd love to see, Mr. Osborne, anyone, all of our politicians do it. Let's have a look at
We do have somewhat more strict regulations in Parliament.
They are obliged to declare outside earnings.
Yes, they are, but they're not obliged to declare assets. And I think that if the British public, for instance, understood just how many millions sat around the cabinet table, they know in theory. But there's something about seeing the numbers that actually makes people think, well, hang on a minute, are they really working in my... Can they understand my life? Are they working in my interests?
I mean, Tim, it is the old journalistic rule to the effect that, two is merely a coincidence. It takes three before there's a trend. But Ali Bongo in Gabon, president thereof, last month promised to give away the not insubstantial money he inherited from his father, Omar, who was clearly a very careful saver of his public sector salary all those years.
A brilliant investment manager.
Well, obviously, commendable prudence. Is it too much to hope that there might be a general change on this front in Africa, that a new generation of leaders might actually realise that, one, it's harder to get away with this stuff now, and two, it recycles poverty is all it does, and everybody hates you for it.
When President Obama made that, which I thought was a brilliant speech in Addis Ababa in Ethiopia recently on his Africa tour, the standing ovation he virtually got was when he talked about this, about corruption, and he even named a couple of leaders. And to say, for example, in Burundi, he made it plain he feels the guy should not be going for a third term. And he actually spelled it out.
Mr. Nkurunziza.
Yeah. And there was the absolute applause from rank and file. I mean, and it was genuinely and spontaneous. So I think there is a groundswell of it. If it does happen, it will be gradual. And there is also another slight problem that culturally, you are expected to share it about with your cousins. So if you are in a position of power, you are not doing the right thing culturally if you don't make sure that your cousin gets a slice of this action, which we would call corruption, nepotism, that is actually
not unheard of.
Indeed not.
I mean, Isabel, final thought on that from you as well. Is it, Are these two incidents, I guess, a couple of hopeful straws in the wind? Is it more difficult now to pull this stuff off in an age in which people can communicate and get access to news faster and quicker than they could have when you know, the likes of Mobutu and Bokassa were looting their countries?
Harder to pull off corruption.
Yeah.
I don't think it's noticeably harder to pull off corruption because there's been such an impunity about it. I mean, it has been, as it were, the kind of default position of an African leader, which is why I do think, I mean, I'm very pro this gesture. It's saying, no, you don't have to be like that. And actually, there's a virtue in not being like that. It would be very nice if this became a trend.
Okay, well, we will return finally tonight to China. It's fair to say that the People's Republic has been more noteworthy for its military and economic prowess than its progress in the field of civil rights, not least when it comes to its treatment of a gay population, which must run comfortably into the tens of millions. Electroshock conversion therapy was only outlawed in December. However, for the first time, official censors have approved the release of a film about a relationship between two men, Wang Chao's Sikh McCartney. Isabel, how big a deal is this?
I think it's a pretty big deal. It's interesting that the French were involved in this. The French have rather pioneered all kinds of sexual liberation in China. It was a French citizen who was involved in the first petition to be allowed to marry a Chinese citizen after the Cultural Revolution, and it had to go all the way to Deng Xiaoping. Two students, French students, had fallen in love with a Chinese student. So the French are kind of, here we are again, you know, pushing forward the boundaries. I think it's quite a big deal because, although, you know, in cities like Beijing or Shanghai, there is now a gay scene in China. It's relatively new. It wasn't so long ago that, for instance, when the AIDS epidemic was getting underway in China, and there's a big AIDS problem, this was regarded as basically a disease that foreigners had introduced to China and, you know, traded amongst themselves. And the idea that there was a, you know, that being gay, you could be Chinese and gay, was something that a Communist Party official seemed to have tremendous trouble getting his or her head around. So actually to have something approved for public showing is a big measure of how far we've come. It doesn't necessarily open the floodgates, I would say, but it is nevertheless significant.
Tim, do you think autocracies are inevitably more socially repressive than democracies? I mean, China only decriminalised homosexuality in 1997, although,
yes,
in fairness, I think that was around the same time Tasmania got around to
it. And many other countries. But it's, you know, it's still there's the death penalty in several countries still for it. I think that autocracies are inherently more repressive because you're talking about freedoms and they don't want to let go of the control of people's freedoms, which is another very small sign of the modern China. And it plays back into what you were saying about all the people that make fun of the Chinese government inside China before their tweets are taken down or whatever. So I think it plays into that. I think it plays into the fact that it is 2015 and they get it. At least they don't have a religious problem. It's only societal. And it's not a subject I know that much about, Chinese homosexuality, but I did a wee bit of reading today, and apparently back in the Han Dynasty, there are lots of references to it, and emperors that had male lovers. And I didn't know this, you might do. Apparently there's this old tale going back 2,000 years. The emperor woke up next to his boyfriend, and his boyfriend had nailed his sleeve to the floor to prevent him going, so he had to cut his sleeve off. And slang for homosexuality in China, I am told, is cut sleeves.
Cut sleeves, it's true. Yeah. I mean, it's not, and, you know, culturally, it's obviously, you know, existed. The Puritanism arrives with communism. And I think what's interesting about this is, to some extent, the party is choosing what it wants to fight about. And it has been in retreat for the past 20 or 30 years about trying to control the bedroom. You know, so we've had a lot of prostitution, we've had a lot of divorce, we've had a lot of sex before marriage. And this is, if you like, just another frontier of that kind.
Okay, well, we will have to leave it there, unfortunately. Isabel Hilton and Tim Marshall, thank you both very much as ever for joining us at Midori House. That is all for today's episode, which was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Federica Romaniello and Aidan McLaughlin. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond, I think I'm right in saying. For the next half hour, there'll be more of Monocle's International Playlist. At 1900 hours, Marcus Hippie is in with the menu. Then at 2200, I'm back with Emma Nelson for the Monocle Daily. Midori House returns on Monday at 1800 London time. But for this edition, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening. Have a good weekend.